Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Leander Caney, publisher of Cult of Mac and a book author. Leander, good afternoon. Thank you for being with me on the show.
Sure, John. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you here. I've been a big fan of your books for a long, long time, and I want to ask you about those in a few minutes. But first, just so the listeners can get to know you better, I'd like to ask you about sort of your background a little bit, do a short biography. There's no doubt from your accent, you were born in the UK, is that right?
That's right, yeah, born in London and grew up in the Midlands near Birmingham.
How did you get to the United States?
Well, my dad was American. He was the only American that ever emigrated to England from America. Usually it's the other way around. And so I have dual citizenship, and I got laid off from a job, a newspaper job in the UK, and I had a bit of money, and I'd never come to America. But of course, you know, like every other kid in the UK and all around the world, was, you know, knew a lot about American pop culture and about, you know, American books and literature, and, you know, I mean, we're all sort of like faux Americans or wannabe Americans. So I was really dying to come here, and I didn't intend to stay. But because I'm a dual citizen, because I got a U.S. passport, you know, it's not a problem. So I just ended up staying. It was an accident. I was going to go back to London.
Is it easy to keep dual citizenship? Just curious.
It is for the U.K., yeah. There's a special, you know, there are certain countries that have special status. And so I don't have to renounce. With some countries, I think when you become a naturalized citizen, you have to renounce U.K. citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's the same situation with, you know, Ted Cruz, right? You know, he's a Canadian citizen, but he's also a U.S. citizen because he's born to U.S. parents abroad. So, you know, that's my status and my, you know, that because my dad was American, I automatically get I'm eligible for a U.S. passport and a British passport.
Of course, of course. So growing up in London, looks like you started doing writing pretty early on, writing for local newspaper, and then I want to hear about your Yugoslavia experience.
Yeah, well, out of college, I got a job at a local newspaper in Milton Keynes, which is a new town just outside of London. And it was sort of the end of that era of British newspapers, heavily unionized, and there was you had to go through a special training course. And I didn't want to be at a local paper in a small town outside London. I wanted to work for the big London newspapers, so I did a lot of freelancing. And I did some stories for, you know, some of the big London newspapers. But on one occasion, I got sent to Yugoslavia. The war in Yugoslavia was going on. And
how did you feel about being sent? I may ask.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to a lot. It's a good way to kickstart a journalism career.
Oh, like Richard Engel, I guess, right?
Yeah, there was a lot of people that were dying that, you know, that wanted to go over there, and you know, there's this sort of Hemingway-esque you know, lure of adventure, and it's very sort of testing, and there were some and of course, it's right in our backyard. It was in Europe, so it was pretty easy to sort of, you know, you could almost hitchhike there, and there was a lot of, you know, a lot of people got careers started by going over there and being war correspondents. But I got sent on this. It was a strange trip. It was organized by a bunch from Luton, by a bunch of Pakistani Muslims. There was a big Pakistani community in Luton. And they sympathized a lot with the Bosnians, who were being ethnic cleansed by the Serbians because of their religion. They were Muslim. So they raised some money to bring back a busload of kids from a refugee camp in Croatia. And it was on the Dalmatian coast. So it was this refugee camp was actually in a summer camp for tourists. It's a beautiful part of the world. It's like, you know, it's Mediterranean. It's just like Italy or Greece. So it's kind of strange. When we got there, there was a big, big refugee camp. There was a bunch of German and Italian tourists all sunbathing on the beach. And then all of these refugees from Bosnia wandering around. And they'd all had awful experiences. And we brought back a busload of kids. And there was a whole bunch of military there too. So there was all these Croatian militias driving tanks and armored cars around and lots of guns and soldiers. It was a really, really strange strange trip, and it totally cured me of any
obviously
war correspondent. I heard all of these stories that these people had gone through, and it was really a terrible, really bitter war. I didn't want to do that anymore. So
at some point, because you're famous for your Macintosh work, at some point you must have fallen into the Mac world and fallen into writing for Wired. How did that happen?
When I came to America, I talked my way into an internship at the Sacramento Union, which was a failing newspaper in Sacramento. And it was, but when I got there, it was down to a real skeleton staff, and it was basically, like a leaflet. It was basically the front and back page, and then there was a four-page gun dealer advertisement. So that was the only thing that was propping up the paper. They had like four pages of gun ads and the front and back page of this newspaper. So it was supposed to be a free internship, but they ended up paying me like $100-$150 per story, because I'd had a bit of newspaper experience.
What year was this?
92.
$150 a story.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I like that.
Much better than you get for blogging these days.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I, but then that folded too. I'd actually come out because the newspaper I'd been working for in the UK folded, and I got some severance money. And then, you know, I was 6 months at this paper, and it folded as well. So I'm like the angel of death for newspapers. But by that time,
Don't feel that way. It's just sort of like the writer's plight, right? You move from place to place.
Indeed, right. And there's been a lot of turmoil in the media industry, you know, and this was sort of the beginning of it. I mean, it got even worse after that with the rise of the internet. But I'd made some friends in San Francisco, so I came here, and my first job was a bike messenger. I had a bicycle, so I took my way into a job as a bike messenger. But I wanted to get into like journalism and get back into journalism. But of course, it's hard to get a newspaper job. They're really coveted. And the industry here was for tech magazines. So I started freelancing for some tech magazines, PC Computing, PC World. Can't remember the other ones. Forbes, I did some work.
That's how I got started. I started writing for Byte and Microcomputing.
Right. Yeah. And at that time, I mean, PC Computing was like the size of a telephone directory. It was gigantic. And
I remember that was like, 500-600 pages?
Yeah, it was mad.
It was incredible. And it was every 2 weeks.
Right, and they would sell more and more ads. There was, and then they'd have to add some editorial pages. So they would, you know, get someone like me. I get called down. I'd have to go down to Foster City, and the guy would hand me like two or three boxes of software. And he said, okay, we need reviews of all this stuff by the end of the week. So I cut a few corners. I don't know if I admit this, but, you know, I was a producer, right? So I would actually do, you know, I was able to produce these reviews. And to be honest, I wasn't able to. In fact, I didn't even have a PC. So,
no, wait a minute. Wait. How did that happen?
I don't know if I want to get too much into this. I want to reveal all, you know, like how I managed to do this stuff. But, you know, needless to say,
that's quite a secret.
I took a few shortcuts. Yeah. But then I got a job at MacWeek, and I don't know if you remember MacWeek, but it was the weekly news paper about the Macintosh.
Oh, I remember subscribing to MacWeek. That was our Bible. I remember Henry Knorr and Don Crabb were inspirations to me.
So this was like around 95, 96. And of course, you know, this is sort of like when there was a lot of turmoil at the company and it was really in trouble. And So MacWeek was suffering too because Apple was in trouble. And, you know, a lot of the stories we did were about sort of like Windows NT and, you know, all these machines that were coming out that were doing the stuff that people traditionally bought Macs for, high-end video, Photoshop, you know, all the kind of creative industries that adopted the Macintosh were getting their lunch eaten And then, of course, there was the clones. You remember Power Computing and Motorola. And so we were doing all these stories about all the clones, and they seemed to be, you know, going gangbusters. If anyone was doing well, it was the clone manufacturers. And, of course,
they were hurting Apple pretty badly.
Right, exactly. They were. It wasn't clear at the time, from what I can remember, that they were doing that. But and then, of course, there was a lot of drama and soap opera about the company itself. And they hired Gil Emilio, and he was, you know, supposed to be a turnaround artist, and he'd perform miracles at the previous company, but you know, was really ineffective. So he had this really couple of disastrous appearances at Macworld, and he bought Steve and Steve Wozniak out. And announced that they were going to bring him back. I remember that was a huge shock when they announced the next. Yeah, that was a subject of a lot of speculation about who they were going to buy to fix Copeland, the next operating system, and of course B seemed to be the front runner.
Yeah, B looked like they had it locked up, and then Steve Jobs did his famous WebObjects demo.
Right. And none of this, from what I can remember, was apparent at the time. It was all very, you know, Apple was just secretive then as secretive now. And of course, a lot of this has come out in the history books, and the sort of blanks have been filled in. But when they announced that they bought Next, I remember that being a huge bombshell. Everyone was totally surprised.
What a steal, too. I mean, in these days, in bloated startup companies, I think it was $400 million to acquire Next.
Right.
What a deal.
I know. And I think people thought, I remember, you know, people thought they'd overpaid, and you're right, it is. It's peanuts, really, compared to some of the prices that companies are being paid these days. But, you know, Jobs' reputation was really in tatters then. I mean, he got no respect from anybody. And I remember people thinking that, well, this is the last nail in the coffin, because he was seen as just this slick marketer. And that he'd managed to, you know, ride Steve Wozniak's coattails for the first go round at Apple, and then he'd, you know, managed to rip off some other investors like Ross Perot. You know, he sunk a bunch
and
of X and Canon, right? So he was. I remember, you know, people thought, oh my goodness, this is another gigantic mistake. So yeah, it was interesting times, and we had a bunch of executives, I remember, in at MacWeek to interview them. You know, this is when they would, it's funny, you know, because I mean, the executives would come down to Mac Week to do an interview. These days, that seems unthinkable. You know, I mean, your journalists get summoned to Cupertino to, you know, very, very rarely to maybe do a sit down with some of the folks there. But yeah, in those days, I mean, I think Mac Week and the media was, you know, powerful enough that it could summon the executives to our offices.
Nice. But it wasn't long after that MacWeek folded.
Right, it turned into E Media Weekly.
Oh yeah, I remember that now.
That's when they wanted to do all the cross-platform stuff, you know, because Windows NT was, I think, taking over such huge chunks of market share. I mean, you know, the professional Mac was really collapsing, and the only thing sort of keeping it alive with it was that there were loyal customers, you know. It was a really interesting time because there was a lot of very, very loyal customers of Apple who would buy the machine sort of like out of mercy, just to sort of, you know, try to the company going. I remember Guy Kawasaki's Evangelist, you know, was a huge, would really marshal the forces. And if people like John Dvorak, you know, wrote something muddle-headed about the Mac or Apple, he would get in at his voicemail machine. His phone wouldn't stop ringing all day. He would get bombed with emails and all sorts of rude messages. And a lot of this would be prompted by, you know, a mention in the Evangelist. So eMedia Weekly, that didn't last very long either, maybe another year or two. I can't remember. But at that time, I was doing a lot of freelancing for Wired News. And the internet was starting to take off as a, you know, an outlet for tech news. And I got offered a job by them. And I remember going and asked, you know, the first question I asked in the interview was like, you know, do you think this website's going to be around in 6 months? You know, I'm really nervous about leaving an established publication for a, you know, fly-by-night website. Yeah. So, I was, you know, really concerned about jumping to the web. And it looked as like it was a risky move. You know, it wasn't clear that the internet was going to take off or become what it has become. So it was definitely risky, but, Media Weekly didn't seem to be going anywhere. And, Wired News, you know, seemed a lot more interesting.
I think this is a very good place to take a break. I want to talk to you after the break about the forming of Cult of Mac and a little bit about Apple. But right now, folks, we have to take a short commercial break. Stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we are back with Leander. Thanks, Kelly. So when you decided to create Cult of Mac, tell me about how the transition went from Wired into Cult of Mac. How did that happen? Because things were not going so well with the Mac industry then.
No, it was, at Wired I became like their Apple reporter. So I was reporting on Apple, and it was, by this point, I guess, like sort of, I don't know, 98, 99, jobs had come back. They had just released the iMac, which I remember people thought was crazy. And they thought it was doomed because it didn't have a floppy drive. And I was doing stories about that and about the ripoff. And suddenly all these PC companies started copying them. There was like Daewoo, I think, and a couple of other machines. Anyway, so that was, you know, that was great. Great time to be a reporter. But it was hard to get any information out of Apple, you know. It was difficult to get scoops. So,
unlike the Mac leak days.
Yeah, right. Mac leak, precisely. Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely unlike that. He really buttoned it up. In the Mac, you're right, you're totally right. In the Mac leak days, I mean, there were so many fiefdoms and there were so many people competing for attention. And the best way, like if you, and they were putting money into everything. They had all kinds of projects going on. And one of the best ways to get the attention of management or the executives was to try to get some press for your project. So they would leak stuff all the time. So when jobs came back, it became really, really secretive. So it was difficult to get stories. So I started noticing that this was the early days of the internet, and I started noticing all the different ways that people were into Apple, were into their machines, would express their their devotion to the brand.
It was like, almost like a cult. So how could that be?
I started doing all these stories about this subculture. It seemed like a genuine subculture, like Hell's Angels or fans of a certain soccer team. To use an analogy from Britain, or fans of a band, they would call themselves the Cult of Mac. So I started a blog that collected a lot of these stories, and it was stories about people with tattoos and Macworld. People would take vacations at Macworld; they'd spend their vacation at Macworld, and at that time it was twice a year in San Francisco and New York, and they would get married at Macworld. And I was fascinated that there was, by this phenomenon, and a lot of it was sort of being expressed over the web at the time. So I started the blog, and then, Apple Wired News actually went through, the first bust, the bubble, the tech bubble, when that burst in 2000.
Yeah, the dot-com bust.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, there was, Wired News had a sort of checkered history, and there was layoffs, and I got all these field promotions. So I got to be the tech editor, and then I got to be the managing editor, and then I was the news editor. And meanwhile, I'd collected these stories that I'd written into a book, Cult of Mac. And then I got commissioned to do a book about Steve Jobs. So my day job was running the Wired News, the Wired website. But at the same time, I wanted to, sort of keep a keep writing. I wanted to keep a presence. So I started writing this. I kept up the Cult of Mac blog in my spare time. So I go home in the evenings after I put the kids to bed. I would put up a few blog posts and I try to promote my books and sort of keep it alive that way. I made a big fight over it, like who owned it. I took it independent. I'm sorry. What I did is I set up my own domain and I got some soft WordPress, I think, and you know, said, okay, I'm just going to take ownership of this. And then we got into a fight about it because they said, you can't do that. It's a wired property. So I just stopped doing it. And of course it died fairly quickly. And then when it was worth nothing, I eventually got it back.
Like, how long did it take you to write your first book?
Well, that was, you know, it was mainly a collection of all the stories I'd written for Wired News, and I got permission to reprint them. So it was the problem. Well, most of the new writing was sort of finding a way to string them together into sort of a coherent book. You know, so I'd done stories about people with tattoos, and I'd done stories about people who made origami Macs and people who designed all of these, what I call fantasy Macs, but, you know, like these speculative designs. People would make 3D renderings of you know, how they think products would look. And, you know, I did profiles of various people. So most of the work was stringing that together, you know, putting all these stories, the related stories, into a chapter, and then trying to write an introduction that would make sense for why all these stories were collected together. And, I don't know, it didn't take that long. Cool. But the other one, the Steve Jobs book, was a really horrible, hairy nightmare. That's a good answer.
Why was that?
Well, again, I was writing in my spare time, quote unquote spare time, four kids, full time job, and I was working sort of weekends and evenings. And
it doesn't show in your books. I've loved everything you've ever written, and it doesn't show. I think your books are so deep, so well researched.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. It seems that way.
Well, you know, to me, they always seem like hack jobs, and all I can see is, you know, all the flaws and all the mistakes.
If we only knew how the sausage was made, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, yeah, actually, I went back. I'm doing it, and we're doing a second version of Mac Week. Oh, I'm sorry, Cult of Mac. So the first book, and you know, it's 10 years old now, so a lot of it is very dated, and it very much is a product of its time, you know, the sort of early days of the internet, and about a subculture that was supporting a company that was going out of business, that people thought was doomed, and you know, look what's happened in the last 10 years, in the last dozen years, it really has changed around. It's completely different. So we're trying to update that now and try to do I'm working with a couple of writers here on the blog, but yeah, writing books is awful. I mean, it's a dreadful way to try to make a living.
Well, that was my next question. How do you feel about the profitability of a book versus the time spent on it?
It's, you know, I probably made less than minimum wage. It's all totaled up.
I think that's what we all make if you figure out the hours and the money.
Yeah. But there's other benefits, you know. I mean, immediately you become an authority on a subject. So it gives you, a lot more sort of, a reputation, you know, that you don't get.
Does it get you any invites with Phil Schiller?
No. The opposite. The opposite, yeah. Well, the latest one, Johnny Ive, I was hoping that I could pull what was the name of that? Andrew Morton, you know, with Princess Diana. I don't know if you remember this. This is a big famous book in the UK. He got sort of Princess Diana's blessing and help in the background. And even though she wasn't officially involved, you know, she helped put him in contact with all these people. And for some strange reason, I'd actually met and interviewed Johnny Ive a few times. And he always, you know, was very friendly and remembered who I was. And so for some, you know, pathetic reason, I felt that he might do the same and sort of, you know, help me with this book. But of course, I didn't get any help whatsoever. There was a lot of work, a lot of research. But I actually got lucky because I ended up talking to one of the designers from the industrial design studio, Doug Satzke, who'd worked there for a dozen years. And, he told me a lot. I did 5 or 6 hours worth of interviews with him and got a bunch of stuff that actually quite a lot of it, you know, didn't make it into the book because there was actually too much detail about how Apple works. And when I was working with the editor and the publisher, we debated what to do with this because it would go on these long digressions about the processes at Apple, you know, the design, you know, how they set up factories, how they worked with all these different engineers and these engineering groups, how they did Q&A. And it sort of tripped up the narrative. You know, there would be these long digressions and then...
Your readers like spicy stuff.
Yeah, well, there wasn't, you know, I mean, he's lived a very... I wanted to concentrate on the products and on the things that he's achieved. So I didn't want to make it... I wanted to make it a working biography, you know, a biography about the work. And to a certain extent, I think it, you know, it succeeds on that.
It does.
But, you know, so we thought about putting all this detail into appendices at the back. And then we decided, well, you know, maybe I should publish them on the web. So I've actually got quite a lot of material that I never did actually publish on the web.
Well, you know, maybe there's another book.
Yeah, that was suggested too, like doing it as an ebook. Yeah.
We only have a few minutes left, so I want to take the time we have left to ask you about, jump forward and talk about the current day Apple. I can't wait to hear what you think about the success of Apple and what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong. And I'm curious what you think about this new 4-inch iPhone, what they're calling the 5 SE or the 6C. I've heard both. How are you feeling about Apple in 2016?
Well, it's a phenomenon. It's the most fascinating company in the world, I think, and it's on the cusp of of what seems to be some huge changes. If it's true that they're building a car, I think
do you think it's just about certain, or do you have some reservations?
Well, this. I have some reservations. You know, I'm not 100% sure. It's a big leap, but
do you think they'll go autonomous first, or do you think they'll go with a conventional electric car if they do, and then fold in the autonomous part later?
Yeah, I think they'd have to go with a conventional car because the regulatory environment and the insurance environment isn't ready for an autonomous vehicle. There'd have to be big changes in the law before that, you know, can happen. No one at the moment is the law is you have to have a driver behind the wheel, right? It's totally illegal. You can't stick an autonomous car.
I think there's a kerfuffle in California between Google and the state of California about whether there's going to be driver controls in an autonomous car. Google wants to get rid of them. State of California says, no, we have to have steering wheel brakes and gas for emergencies.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So yeah. What I'd heard is that, you know, Elon Musk said that, you know, in a couple of years you'll be able to summon, the technology will exist to be able to summon your Tesla from across the country.
Yeah, I saw it move out of a garage under iPhone control, right. But that was only about 5 meter movement.
Yeah, well, it has a lot of autonomous, the lane assist, and it'll also leave the freeway and park itself. And he's the way that he describes it is that they will have these features in a couple of years and they'll run it. They'll run all these simulations or they'll collect all this data from all these Teslas in real world situations. And then he thinks after several years of data that showed that had the car been under its own control, had it been driving autonomously, you know, this is how safe it would have been. And that would be the data that the insurance and political institutions need to be able to change the laws to make them right. Fully autonomous.
I wrote about that a couple of weeks ago. If the insurance companies won't insure the car, then you won't buy the car.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I think that these are the big hurdles, not necessarily the technology. But also, you know, like look at the electric drivetrain. I saw a graph on the web a couple of days ago that showed the numbers of EV, plug-in EV sales, and they're starting to hockey stick. It looks exponential. So, you know, I think with all of the concerns about global warming and gas, carbon emissions, that the drivetrain, the technology behind the car, plus all the smarts, the networking, the telemetrics, I think there's going to be a big change there over the next few years. And this, I works perfectly to Apple's advantage. They have a lot of expertise. You know, I don't know, is a car like a giant iPhone? Electric car, you know, it has a battery. It's all about battery power management,
integration of hardware and software,
right? And sensors, yeah, exactly. So I don't know if it's analogous, but maybe.
Are you convinced there will be an iPhone S5 SE 4-inch screen on March 21st?
It looks like it. I mean, there's hardware leaks, so it's...
What do you think the motivation by Apple is to go back to the 4-inch size?
I think that they're, you know, they're doing what they did with the iPod. You know, the iPod eventually came in a whole range of different sizes and with different capabilities and different price points. You know, there was an iPod at every $50, I think, between, you know, $100 and $550. And I think that, you know, that it makes sense to maybe not do that with the iPhone, but, you know, to have a range of sizes. I know that, you know, what are the numbers? I mean, I think a quarter of iPhone customers are still using 4-inch screens. And a lot of people think that, you know, that the 6 and the 6S is, I'm sorry, the 6 and the 6 Plus is way too big.
You think a March introduction of a new phone every year is sort of a way to even out the iPhone cash flow and prop up sales?
I don't know. You know, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, it is unusual that they're introducing it this time of year. Yeah, I don't know. What did you think? Mm-hmm.
I think it's a way, as you said, to kind of fill in the price line and the product line so that the second quarter doesn't look so dismal. Because, you know, when September starts to roll around, people in August think, well, I'm not going to buy a new phone now because there'll be a new one in September. And then you get the Christmas quarter and everybody buys phones right for Christmas. And then January rolls around and everybody who wanted a phone got a phone at Christmas time. And the January, February, March quarter can be kind of a bleak quarter for Apple. Right.
Yeah.
Do you have an iPad Pro?
I do, yeah.
What do you think of that?
I think it's great. I like it. I love the big screen. But, you know, to my great shame that I don't really put it through its paces. I don't use it for what it's really good at, which is, you know, with a pencil for sort of creative design work. You know, I mainly just read the web on it.
Well, it's a blessing for things like magazines.
Yeah. It's lovely. It's a huge screen. You know, the only thing I don't like about it is that it just shows up all the greasy fingerprints much more clearly.
Yes, it does.
I still like the Air 2. I still have an Air 2, and I actually find that, you know, that it's a lot easier to read. I do a lot of, you know, reading on the iPad, so I like that. I've got one next to my bed, and I tend to turn towards the smaller one just for reading. But yeah, it's certainly a beautiful device. And I think it's, you know, I'm seeing a lot more stuff about, you know, enterprise software for iOS and for enterprise uses. And I was reading something about how someone, you know, has completely started using the iPad full time, mainly because of its note-taking abilities with the pencil. And that was interesting. So I'm sort of seeing some traction in business circles for the iPad and for the iPad Pro.
Do you think the iPad Mini line will disappear?
I don't know. People love that. And I think, you know, probably the same thing. I think that they can coexist at a range of sizes and price points.
Yeah, I know that it's a lot more fun to read in bed with an iPad Mini than it is with a much larger iPad. It's just the right size, just the right weight.
I know, and people say that the iPad, you know, I mean, there's all this doom and gloom about the iPad, but it's an astonishingly successful product. It's just that I think that the people don't upgrade them as quickly as Apple would like. You know, people hold onto their iPads for 3-4 years.
And when they sell 12 million in a quarter and it's down from 15 or 18 million, there's wringing of hands. But when you compare that to the Microsoft Surface that sells about 1 million every quarter, it's a big difference.
Right, absolutely, and it's you know, I think people still haven't quite. We're still in the middle of this, you know. I think it's still early days yet. That I think clearly the tablet is a very successful computing platform.
Do you think OS X and iOS will ever merge in some sense, you detach the screen from your MacBook and it becomes an iOS device?
Yeah, you know, what Apple is, I mean, Tim Cook, I think, and some others have sort of addressed this and said that they think, you know, that it's you know, it's fish and fowl, that the two are best left separate. I haven't used a Surface tablet, and I have. I played around at a Microsoft store, and to be honest, I was completely confused. It was like I had no idea how the thing worked, and I think you might get that. I mean, it would be interesting to see, you know, iOS laptops, I could see them that working. But then I think you get back to what that, you know, Steve Jobs said, which is that it tie, you know, that it doesn't make much sense to put a touchscreen on a laptop or a desktop because it would tie your arms out.
Yeah, you know, that's that, true.
That's holding
it's
up
the
for
old
it.
Toaster fridge thing.
I think yeah. You know, rather than merge, they are definitely merging. I mean, look at all the different features in Yosemite and El Capitan.
Complementary.
Right.
Handoff instead of merging the operating systems and making them work better together.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if anything, iOS will supersede OS X.
OS X has some security issues that just can't be solved the way iOS has. Yeah, interesting. Well, you know, we're just about out of time. I'd like to go on for a while and talk to you some more, but we really got to wrap it up. So thank you very much for being on the show. This has been a fascinating discussion. And so let's wrap it up here and tell the listeners how they can contact you.
You can, my Twitter handle is L Kaney, L-K-A-H-N-E-Y. And of course, you know, I can be found at cultofmac.com. And I have a cult a podcast too called The Cultcast, which can be found on iTunes.
Cool. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show today. Thank you for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.